Welcome to Pullback, the podcast where we're still on a break. Gonna do another book club episode. Woo! I'm Kristen P. I'm here with Kyla Houston. We are proud members of the Harbinger Media Network podcast. I've said all the things. Let's do it.
I mean, it's not a break if we've just put out like a whole season of another show. Everyone go check out Climate Organizing Shorts if you want more from us. They're great for everybody, but especially if you're interested in organizing in your local community. Okay, great.
Yeah, it's the least restful break ever, actually. Good point, Kyla. It's been a lot of work, especially for you.
I don't know. You've been doing a lot of work for, like, it's been a lot of work for everybody. Making a new show is hard work, and we forgot because it's been 4 years since we started Pullback.
Gotta write the show description. You gotta get a website. You gotta get on a podcasting thing. People have to know about the podcast. You have to make people know the podcast.
Oh, man. And discovery and podcasting is a whole thing. But that's not what we're here to talk about. For fun, listener, we read like a 400-page book about the data gap for women in studies and information. I don't know. Kristen, you do a better job than me. How would you describe this book?
Okay. So, women existing in the universe. We all know the world is not made for us in many different ways. This book is just receipt after receipt on that. It's all about how everything is studied based on fucking men, and it doesn't appear to be changing. That's what this book is.
Yes, that's right, listener. We are reading Invisible Women, Data Bias in a World Designed for Men by Carolyn Criado Perez. I loved it. We ended up doing it because I'm on a bit of an audiobook tear, and Kristen was visiting and she's like, oh, what's your favorite audiobook you've heard so far this year? And I was like, oh my God, I really like Invisible Women. I think it's like, it's too big for me to like say that I think everyone should read it. But I also, I don't know, like none of the facts in it I found like particularly shocking, but just, yeah, receipt after receipt. And it just made me go, oh boy. I forgot about that, and I forgot about that, and seeing it all at once, I'm like, oh, maybe we should fix some systems.
I think men should all read this.
Yeah.
If you're a male listener of our show, recommend you read this. Even if you think you're a feminist, it's like good reading. And then if you've ever struggled in arguments about sort of like gender issues and you want more facts, this is a really good one for it. It'll give you tons of ammunition.
Yeah, it's like mostly statistics, which I thought Kristen would enjoy.
I did like the stats.
The author is also like pretty snide sometimes and like has a pretty sarcastic bent for like at the end of almost every paragraph, she's like, who would have thought?
And I think the audiobook is narrated by her, is it not?
It is, yeah.
The sarcasm really drips through, so.
Okay, so the three main topics that she highlights in the introduction that, like, she comes back to over and over again is the idea that, you know, the female body, you know, is different than the male body. She does try to make an effort at the beginning to say, like, hey, I'm not trying to be, like, a trans erasurist. It's just that like all of the stats I'm talking about are very much based on like the physicality of it. And that's the case for a lot of her information. And then a lot of it is like gender specific that would apply to like trans women as well. And trans men, frankly, like
non-binary, the whole everything other than cis men, you know, even some cis men that have small hands. Shout out to the short kings.
Yes. Yeah. And like, I don't know. I found that even though she talks about women kind of generically, it's already such a big book that it's hard to like really account for the diversity of race as well as gender, because that's not really what the book is about. So I didn't find that to be problematic, but I'm white. So maybe I missed something.
I just think not every book needs to be about everything.
Yes. Yeah.
Like this book was a really good account of how the world is dominated by cisgender men and how that leaves out a large portion of the population. It doesn't cover, as you pointed out, doesn't cover the full spectrum of gender diversity, but it makes a very good point in a very robust way. And the like desegregated data point that it makes is useful for all kinds of topics, including like race.
Yeah. And it's also already, like I said, 400 pages long. So, okay, so it's about the female body and how it's different from men. It's about women's unpaid care burden, which comes up over and over and over again, which I always love hearing about. And it's about male violence against women. How do you want to tackle this, Kristen? This book was so comprehensive and so large.
Yeah, I find it a little bit challenging. And I think this goes to like what my problem with the book is. Because to me, it feels like somebody collating facts all together. And that was really good. But it's missing like this theoretical bow that ties it all together. And that sort of gives us a positive program for like what to do about it. You know, at the end of the book, I was like, okay, I've got all this knowledge. Now, what do I do with it? You know, which I understand is like hard. I think when we did that episode on Paris Marx, Road to Nowhere, is that what it's called?
Yes, that's exactly it. You nailed it.
I don't remember whether this was in the pre-interview or the actual thing, but they were talking about writing that book and having it be just sort of like a bunch of stuff about how the world is shitty. And then their editor really forcing them to add that sort of, here's where the world should go at the end. And to me, that is what's missing from the book. And that's what makes it a little bit tricky for me to say, like, where we should start talking about it. Because I always like to start with the main argument, but there isn't really one other than, like, men dominate all of our lives and nothing is built for women or designed for women. And that sucks. And it doesn't work very well.
Okay, fair enough. She does start, like, her introduction is basically example after example of how, like, heroes are male by default and cave paintings are assumed to be by men. And like, women warriors are often, even though their bone structure is clearly feminine, like, are often, like, attributed to be male bones. And it's just, like, women literally don't exist in history, in archaeology, and, like, the history of female erasure in our society today is pretty bad. And then, yeah, she just goes on to kind of tear apart industry after industry, which, I don't know, I really liked. Like, the very first chapter of the book is about how snow clearing can be sexist. And I don't know if you had thoughts on that, Kristen, about the, I mean, it wasn't just about snow clearing. She always kind of starts her chapters with like a central silly idea and then points out like, actually, it's not so silly.
No, I don't know. The snow clearing example, it filled me with feminist rage because it, I didn't even realize that this was a dimension to my hatred of how Ottawa plows the snow, but I was like, yeah, I do use active and public transit. I do like link my trips together rather than just going to and from work. I don't even really have caregiving responsibilities other than me, so, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And so, like, the example that she uses for, like, how snow clearing is kind of sexist is that a politician made a joke about how, well, at least the feminists can't come for snow clearing. And then someone looked at it and was like, actually, you are plowing roads that drivers use before you're plowing sidewalks or public transit routes. And women are falling more often and going to a hospital more often because they're trying to push prams in the snow, or they're just walking to work in the snow and they can't get to work because, you know, public transit isn't being serviced. And it doesn't cost anything different to just plow sidewalks first. And so a bunch of places have started doing that and have found that, like, oh yeah, hospital costs have gone down. Not an issue in the United States, I suppose, but most countries do want to bring their hospital bills down.
Play a huge expense of the welfare state. Really good if you can bring those ER visits down. But I thought it was like a really interesting way to introduce this idea that the way we design our cities is really male dominated and it doesn't take into account. I mean, this is that sort of caregiving point you were talking about, that like women are more likely to be both time and money poor, and so more likely to use active and public transit to get around than to use a car. And they're also much more likely to be taking more complicated trips. And so even stuff like when you introduce bus fares that don't charge for a transfer, that's something that can sort of support women's inclusion because women are often taking caregiving trips. But you also need to think about like the higher likelihood that women are going to be carrying shit because they're more likely to be going to a grocery store or taking a kid to the doctor or something like that. And so if you're just kind of like designing cities with a male bias in mind, you're not going to think about any of those things. And that is how most of our cities run. They are car nightmares.
What? She had a bunch of statistics about how, yeah, men are more likely to own and drive cars, but also that like public transit routes are most likely to be designed like concentrically around a downtown core where men are more likely to be working. And so, yeah, those transfers are happening more often with women because the places that they're going, like the doctor's offices or their relatives' homes, are not like a direct line. Oh, and her next chapter was actually pretty spicy, too. It was about the gender neutral with urinals, the story of the theater that made their bathrooms gender neutral by just saying gender neutral with stalls and gender neutral with urinals. But it's not like gender neutral because women can't actually use urinals. So it just meant that more men were using the women's bathroom. So like it was better for men in the end because they got more stalls, but women still had to queue.
Which like I think if you ask like anybody who doesn't use a urinal, they could have easily predicted that.
Yeah, that's what makes it such a funny example.
Like, of course that happened.
Yeah, like, who thought that up? But then she says, like, 50% of, like, floor space is, like, there's, like, a 50-50 divide between floor space for men's washrooms and women's. But, like, that's not actual equality because women take longer to go to the bathroom because they often have children or they're menstruating or they are looking after someone older or they have like urinary tract infections and have to go more often.
Also, just like the way pants are designed, we have to take our pants off, which I had never thought about as a form of feminist rage, but men can just unzip. The fuck?
And they can stand up. Yeah. And for every like, I don't know, you probably get two urinals in the space of like one stall, right? So you get at least twice as many toilets for men.
Especially if it's one of those trough situations. You can cram a bunch of men into those. Disgusting.
Yeah. Which it's kind of a silly example. And it does like, you know, get that first world feminist on board. And then, because it's like, yeah, I do hate going
to the shots fired, Kyla.
Hey, listen, I went to the theater last night and I saw a Broadway production of the show Hairspray. And the queue for the women's line was very long. And that is a rich person problem. So like, and so she uses that to kind of like bounce off and talk about bathroom rights globally. You know, women are more likely to experience violence in especially countries where bathrooms are really far away from people's homes and they have to go out at night, or maybe there's no bathrooms on site when you're working in a field. And so like men just go anywhere, but there's like the stigma against like women can't urinate in public the same way that men can. Not that I love seeing a man urinating in public, but you definitely see it a lot more than you see women. And then from that, she kind of goes on to, she builds it into an argument about, yeah, just violence in general towards women in public spaces, which is, I don't know, I kind of liked the way that she formed this chapter because it starts with like 50-50 bathroom space isn't actually equitable. And it ends with like public transportation violence against women is unbelievable. And it's like, oh, cool.
Really not safe.
In her third chapter, she talks about in 1975, the UN declared a women's year and the women in Iceland went on strike for like a day.
Pandemonium, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they weren't going to regular work and they also weren't doing their unpaid labor. And I love just imagining children in offices in 1975 with their dads, like hopped up on sugar and the women just relaxing at home. I don't know if it was a direct result of the strike, but Iceland does have like the most gender equal parliament in the world as of 2019 when this book was written. So like women be striking. There was like, I think it was like 90% of women participated. Something unreal. Yeah.
They should give us a day off for International Women's Day.
So many places would just have to shut down.
It would really shut down that argument that, like, men run the world. It's like, statistically, women are doing a lot more work.
Yeah, which this book points out, I think starting in this chapter, where like one of my favorite question mark statistics is that globally 75% of unpaid work is done by women.
This is why we're time and money poor.
Yeah. Maybe not Kristen and I, because we're single. Yeah.
Single, and I have a good unionized job.
Me too now. I'm in a union again. In the same chapter where she's talking about kind of the unpaid, invisible work that women do, there was a study which found that husbands create an extra 7 hours of housework a week for women. And like, it was just one study. Maybe it's not accurate, but it feels true. A lot of this chapter is about the gender pay gap. And I think you and I know enough about this that it's not shocking for us when she says something like, when women join an industry in high numbers, the industry attracts lower pay and loses prestige, which kind of negates the argument that like a lot of people who argue about whether the wage gap really exists are like, well, just go get a job that pays more. And it's like, okay, I will. And then they'll start paying me less. See nurses and teachers.
Yeah. One stat that wasn't in this book, and I did not expect it to be, but there was a report from the Conference Board of Canada a while back. The purpose of the report was not about gender. It was looking at like how much different degrees benefited you over your lifetime income. And they found that in general, the more advanced education you have, the more pay you get over your lifetime, unless you look at the difference between having a penis or not. And then having an undergrad and a penis is more valuable than having a PhD and not having a penis. So really cool.
Ew, I hate it. Because women are more likely to be working, you know, odd jobs or in precarious work or in work that is just like part-time or contract, we don't get pensions to the same level because pensions, especially government pensions, are designed around male sort of working lives. And so like women are way more likely to be living in poverty when they're elder because they just didn't work the same jobs. And that's, we are looking at data right now, which means that women who are living off of pensions now maybe weren't even allowed to earn pensions when they first started working, depending on where they were.
Yeah, but it's also like women have access to less generous pensions, which is like one major way that people save. Obviously, it's like the retirement savings program. But the other major way that people like build assets to take care of them when they're old is oftentimes through like housing. And women, especially like single parents, have much less access to the housing market. And so they're less likely to have both of those sources. So it means that like seniors' poverty in a lot of cases is gendered, which is not great.
Oh, one of my favorite statistics in the book, this is unrelated to pensions, I'm just flipping through and looking at the stuff I've highlighted, is that America, what is going on? So many of the stats, she had to like make special notes for America because it was just such a disaster. She's like, oh, in the UK and Canada and Australia and the global south. And
she went to town on paternity benefits in like Canada and Europe. And she's like, okay, now America.
Yeah. That's exactly. So yes, which is that 1 in 4 American mothers return to work within 2 weeks of giving birth. You just
can't be safe.
You're still wounded. You're still wounded. You just like had a battle wound, essentially. Like I highlighted a few sections in the fact that like universities tried to fix the issue of women getting tenure less often after giving birth.
And ended up inadvertently helping men publish more. Yeah.
Yeah. So essentially they give people like an extra year off, but it's like for both parents. And unlike women who might be throwing up or going to the bathroom all the time or changing diapers or pumping their breasts, men just get to dedicate a whole extra year to their research and writing. And so like it makes them more hireable later. Like, cool, full story. It led to a 22% decline in women's chances of gaining tenure. Great job. The paternity stuff, though, I really liked it because it was like a study in Sweden in 2010 found that a mother's future earnings increased by an average of 7% for every month of leave taken by the father. And now there's like I think most fathers in Sweden take like 3 or even 4 months of paternity leave because it's like mandated. It's like, oh, you get this much. And if you don't use it, then it goes away. And you can't just transfer it to the woman. Like you either take it or you don't. So like men in Sweden take it and they love it. And they become more hands-on fathers and do more of the work later on in the relationship. Like it's just better. I love it.
Yeah, that was like my conflict with that academia study that she pointed out. Because like you can't deny the evidence. It's a bad outcome. But I think in general, we do want parental leave to be for both parents and for the norm to be that both parents take it. So I think there it's like less the policy instrument and more just sort of like the underlying inequities that you have to fix. Or maybe give it like a little extra time because women, they're just all kinds of damaged down there after giving birth. Gotta heal, man.
What did you think about this chapter 4 is about the myth of meritocracy and kind of the idea that people are biased against women. What? So women are less likely to be chosen for stuff. But there's like a whole section about how female professors are kind of rated more poorly and are expected to do more of like the caregiving work of looking after their students or giving them extensions and stuff. And you are an academic. What say you?
I have gotten some sexist as hell comments, and some of them were nice comments, but I was like, these are deeply problematic. I'm not your mom. I'm not your girlfriend. I am your teacher. This is weird. Yeah, teaching evaluations, there's like a big discussion in academia about them because they are irredeemably, I think, sexist. It really sucks. But I really liked this chapter as a whole. Especially like the stats that she brought out about this idea that like the more you buy into the ideology that like a place is a meritocracy, the more sexist and less meritocratic you are. And I was like, that tracks with like the anecdotal evidence I have of people who have said we're a meritocracy, we're not woke, you know? They are missing the point.
She points to an example at Google of how like you're supposed to be like self-referring yourself for promotions, and men were self-promoting, like they were self-referring themselves all the time, and women just like never were, because, you know, if you're a woman and you tell people that you're great, people hate you. So they ended up holding workshops to encourage women to be more like men. That was their solution, and it did not work.
Yeah, and I also liked the idea she brought forward, which I didn't actually know this because I had heard the stat before that like people tend to overvalue their intelligence relative to the average, but I did not realize that that was gendered and that women actually tend to accurately assess themselves. Like, Jesus Christ!
Yeah, that's in the same paragraph as the Google promotion thing, which is like, maybe the issue isn't that women's rates of putting themselves up for promotion are too low. Maybe it's that men's are too high.
Maybe. Should be some humility workshops, you know?
Yeah, for real. The whole chapter started with a story of how some orchestra, she used one orchestra as an example. I'm sure plenty of them do it now, but they didn't used to do blind auditions. And so like 90% of musicians were men in the orchestra. And then they put a screen up so that you couldn't see the gender of the person playing. And like, lo and behold, suddenly 50% of the people in orchestras are women, like, because they play just as well as men.
Incredible innovation. Love to see it.
And so like some tech startups have started like blind recruitment systems where you get people's like work without getting any of their, like you don't get their name or any associative data. And that has changed it so that instead of hiring like 60% or 70% or more men, they're hiring like almost 50-50 now. And it's like, okay, cool. That's good to know.
Shocking how 50% of the population
is just as competent. Chapter 5, she called the Henry Higgins effect. And I don't know if you're a big My Fair Lady stan.
I did not get the reference until she explained it to me.
I got it right away because I'm cool. But what am I, like, this is another one where she starts with something fairly innocuous, which is that the temperature in the average office is about 5 degrees too cold for women based on like body mass and stuff like that. Read the book and she explains it. But the whole story of this chapter is like, why can't women just be more like men? Including like, why are bricks the size they are? They fit men's hands, but not women's. Why are bags of cement as heavy as they are? Men can lift them easily, but it's very difficult for women.
Yeah. Why is a brick had to be that size? I really bought that argument.
I know. I loved that. Was like, that was, I think that was the example, because it's so small and so good that I was like, damn. Yeah. I really like this book. Like, standard hand tools, like wrenches, are too large for most women's hands. Not forcing women to march at the same capacity as men in the army has, like, reduced hip problems for women because they're shorter.
Oh, yeah. And wasn't it, like, there were some workplaces where they wouldn't even get, like, they would get PPE that, like, it would be impossible to pee in over a 12-hour shift, or that, like, didn't even fit, like...
Yeah, I think that was like a Coast Guard somewhere. That I think that was in a later chapter. She ties all of this stuff like together pretty well. And it's the same ideas. It's the same three ideas over and over and over again, which is that the female body, sexualized violence, and unpaid care work.
Yeah, like data gap. We don't even fucking know because we're not studying it.
Yeah. What, like the next chapter, being worth less than a shoe, which is a call out to a woman who splashed nail polish remover on a customer's Prada sandals and got fired that same day. And also the owner paid for the woman's sandals out of the last paycheck for the woman who spilled the polish remover. And she's like, I'm worth less than a shoe. That's good to know. Like,
yeah. Precarious work is bad for everybody, but women are more likely to be in precarious jobs.
Yeah. And that's just, this whole chapter is just example after example of how female workers are impacted by precarious work, including last-minute scheduling, which kind of messes you up if you're doing a lot of unpaid care work, like child care or elder care or home care for your husband, since you're doing apparently 7 hours more work than him. Like, not even more than him. Having a husband add 7 hours to your week. I don't know. Late-stage capitalism being what it is. You know, women are kind of working in this 9-to-5 man's world, which means that child care is often 8-to-6. And if you're working a job that isn't 8-to-6 or that's last minute, or maybe you don't know when your schedule is going to be out and you have to like schedule childcare well in advance and it's super expensive, like it's just not.
I don't think this was in this book, but it was something I came across recently. Apparently, they're doing sleep studies on women now, finally. And they've found that like women need like 9 to 10 hours of sleep. It's not the 7 to 8 that we've been told, because that was like based on men.
I saw that too. I saw that recently. And it's like, gosh, I've been beating myself up for years for being like what I thought was an oversleeper, because I need like 9 to 10 hours of sleep. When I was younger, especially in my early 20s, I was like, I was probably actually only getting exactly the amount that I needed. But because I would wake up around like 11 a.m. or 12 p.m., I would just start to cry and then like beat myself up about like how I'd wasted the whole day.
But yeah, this like inherent shame that like we often feel because we don't fit into. And this isn't just like a like cisgender women, cisgender men thing. I think it's any kind of way when we don't fit what society was built for, which is typically like the cis white man. People can really internalize that and create a lot of shame around it. So one of the things I really liked about this book is that she'd point out these discrepancies between men and women, like statistically. But then she'd also talk about how like changing these things would be better for everybody, because there's a lot of men that don't really fit into this category too. You know, if we're building society for the average man, there's like a whole group of men in that category even for whom that's not going to work very well too. So.
All right. Well, I'm going to move on to the next topic, although I am going to quickly point out, because she in the chapter where she talks about like how women are not treated like they're worth anything in the workplace, nurses are subjected to more acts of violence than police officers or prison guards, which is a fact that I probably intrinsically knew, but it's nice to be reminded of. And I just wanted to shout that out, because when nurses, I don't know how they do it.
Yeah, they should be paid a lot more.
And also fewer hours. I think everybody... I don't know. There should be like a rule where everybody has to be a nurse like one day a month. Like,
or in some kind of like caregiving role.
Yeah, I don't know. They're so understaffed, and probably because they're treated so poorly and so underpaid, but
and do so much overtime. Yeah.
They're like the backbone of our whole society. Then there's a whole chapter about how difficult it is for women business owners to receive funding and investment because they're more likely to be trying to disrupt an industry that's like focused on women, because women are underserved and understudied. But because most people holding the purse strings are still men, They're still like, oh, I don't know if we need a more comfortable or useful breast pump.
Yeah, I mean, we kind of saw this like in real time with the Barbie movie this year, you know? This whole idea that like anything that speaks to 50% of the population is like a niche issue.
There was one statistic that I do want to share, which is that for every dollar of funding, female-owned startups generate 78 cents compared to male-owned startups, which generate 31 cents. And that's from a study published in 2018 by Boston Consulting Group. And I don't know if it's just because, like, women have to be exceptional to receive funding at all or what that's about, but I liked that statistic and I wanted to share it.
That's like, there was another stat somewhere in the book about quotas for businesses, and they found that it doesn't result in the hiring of unqualified women. What it does do is it stops the hiring of unqualified men.
She actually mentions that twice. Once when it came to quotas for hiring in the business sector, and once when it came to quotas for political parties and having like a 50-50 political party. So it's good in politics and business. She talks about products that are marketed as gender neutral, which are in fact biased towards men in the tech industry. From smartwatches that are too big to apps that fail to account for women's desire for like safest as opposed to just fastest routes when you're looking at maps. VR headsets are way too big for the average woman's head. Speaking of someone who loves Beat Saber, this is for real a problem. Mic packs that require either a waistband or substantial pockets to attach to. Like, there's just so many blind spots. And just seeing them, like, back to back to back listed together, I'm like, oh, this makes me so sad. Designing passive tracking apps as if women have pockets big enough to hold their phones is a perennial problem. She rages against pocket disparity a lot. And I was there for it.
We want pockets. Give us pockets.
She actually has like several pages about motion sickness in VR and how it has something to do with the way that women walk differently and like our inner ear balance is different, but nobody designs for that. She uses the VR to kind of lead into this whole section about how women are 47% more likely to be seriously injured than a man and 71% more likely to be moderately injured in a car accident because cars are designed for men and then tested on male crash test dummies still as of the time of writing of this book, which was 4 years ago. And then we move on to part four, which is just all about going to the doctor and how studies on drugs are done on, I didn't even know this, but apparently, again, at the time of writing of this book, there's no requirement in most countries for drug tests to be done on 50% men and 50% women. So they're mostly done on men because women's caregiving schedules and precarious work schedules make it harder for them to go to drug testing stuff. And also, like, we've got enough stuff to do. Like, there's just fewer women going to get tested for new drugs. And it creates a pretty big problem because women and men have different bodies at almost every level, like all the way from our cells, you know, all the way up to our brains and lungs, and like our skin is different. Like, it's different. People are all different. And if you're ignoring at least 50% of the population, then it's like, oh, suddenly you have drugs that work for men but don't work for women, or we're getting over the average, like, dosage is way too high for women. Oh yeah, females aren't even included in animal studies on female prevalent diseases. Ugh.
Yeah, they're all in like these mutant like male lab rats, like who are nothing like actual rats genetically.
Wait, what? I feel like this was not in the book, and this is just a thing you know.
Yeah. Briefly seeing a neuroscientist who went into a rabbit hole about this, or a mice hole, as you might like to say. No, apparently, like, they just, because they want to control for things in experiments, they want, like, fewer, like, exogenous variables that might make your story more complicated, which is also one of the reasons that they don't study women, because hormone cycles, even though men have hormone cycles too, but anyway. So they inbreed these mice so that they're genetically similar. And so now they're all like Buckingham Palace male white mice.
So it's nice to know that this book is still relevant even 4 and 5 years later. Like, but anyways, all of this just means that like we'll end up with like drugs that work for men that don't work for women or are actively harmful for women. And we don't discover that until like tons of women have started reporting problems and then they get like taken off the shelves or whatever. And it's like, maybe.
We won't know till we do the study.
Yeah, there's like a whole chapter about like how women be dying from heart attacks, but doctors can't recognize heart attacks in women because they're different than heart attacks in men. It's like,
I did a lot of like first aid courses and stuff growing up because I lifeguarded as like my first job. And it was just presented so matter-of-factly always. It was like, these are the symptoms of a heart attack. By the way, you might not know it with a woman because it's going to look different and we don't know. And I don't know why I never questioned that at the time, but it's like, it's 50% of the population. We should probably know what a heart attack looks like for a woman. Like, pretty messed up that, like, you train this cadre of teenagers to recognize the signs of, like, a deadly thing, but only for half the population, because it turns out we haven't bothered to study the other half of the population.
Yeah, and well, and the person training you probably didn't know, right?
Well, I mean, they knew because all the textbooks have that, like, this is what they look like. We don't really know what they look like in women.
What?
Like, every single time it was, yeah. That's why, like, it was a line that I remembered all the time, because every time we did a training, that was something that was mentioned. But, like, I never thought about it as, like, a part of the patriarchy. I don't know why.
Yeah.
It's just like, yeah, women, we're wily.
Well, and, like, the fact that period pain is often, like, the same or more painful than an actual heart attack means that women often don't know when they're having a heart attack because they're, like, their pain sensors are all out of whack.
Yeah, let's not get into endometriosis and all how that's been extremely understudied. We should really know what causes that, but...
Although, listener, if you do want to get into that, it's in this book. This book is very comprehensive when it comes to all of the ways that women, not even all the ways, but many of the more famous ways that women are being underserved by our society that we all exist in. Oh, yeah. And then there's like a whole section about how in the U.S., women no longer have more active years than men. So even though they live longer, this idea that, oh, well, it's okay that women aren't being served by the medical industry because they live longer anyways. And it's like, that's becoming less true. And also the extra years that women do have, they're lived in poverty and disability.
Not that that's to devalue disabilities and like the value of life there. Yeah.
It's that disability justice is still necessary to the point where like, if you live with a disability and you have lots of money, then it's, you know, you can serve yourself, but if you are in poverty and living with, in old age, often many disabilities, and you don't have people to take care of you, it can be a pretty hard way to end your life. Oh, yeah, and there's like a section about how Viagra could help with period pain, but nobody studied that because men hold the purse strings for the studies that people do.
This must have been the chapter I skipped. What a terrible chapter to choose to skip.
Yeah, it's the idea. It basically, she says, like, Viagra was originally tested as a heart disease medication, and they tested it all on men, and they found that, you know, whoopee, it makes your erection happen and last. But the trial didn't include any women, and in 2013, there was a study that found that this drug offered pain relief for over 4 consecutive hours with no observed adverse effects. But before they could bring the trial further, they just ran out of money and nobody will fund it. And it's like, oh, okay. So maybe Viagra would be a really cool period product, but nobody will tell us.
It'd be such a profitable use of the drug too. Like, it's a thing. Presumably, you need it about as much as like men need to get their dicks up like, on average.
She addresses that. She says the failure of pharmaceutical companies to step in here and capitalize on what is surely a gold-plated commercial opportunity may seem baffling, but...
It does seem baffling.
She says it's just another data gap-like problem. There simply isn't much research done on female period pain, which makes it difficult for pharma companies to know exactly how much money could be made on such a drug, and therefore makes it harder for them to decide to fund trials.
Cool. That's really cool.
Yeah, this chapter also has a whole section about weak contractions and how dangerous they can be and how, like, we have all these things that we could do to, like, solve them, but we don't because nobody will pay for the studies.
You know who could pay for the studies is governments.
Yeah, and that leads us to the final section of the book, which is public life and how there aren't enough women in government. And all of the reasons for that to be true, which is often like harassment. And like what, so like when women do become public facing, they are harassed at a higher degree. They're, you know, it's the same with the teaching thing. Like everyone just doesn't respect them the same. But also they're like less likely to be elected in the first place because like the societal bias is that women are incompetent.
There's actually in Canada, there's been studies on this and they find that like when women are on the ballot, there's no gender bias in like voting behavior. It happens like when they're deciding to run and being nominated. So that's kind of a fun fact. I don't know that that's true everywhere, but in Canada, at least.
Good job, Canada. That's nice.
There's one thing that's nice about our society, I guess.
Yeah, but I mean, like, women are less likely to be able to run because of, again, all that unpaid care work that people are doing. So, you know?
Yeah, and they're more likely to be running in less winnable ridings and blah, 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 blah.
Tons of reasons why we need more women in leadership and why we're not getting it. She does spend a fair portion of the, it's near the end of the book, talking about how GDP, I hate GDP, and how like, and how we measure, like we use that to measure the success of our society. And she's like, listen, if we made unpaid care work a paid thing, it would increase GDP. And I was like, I don't love that as an argument, but I do love how that's probably an effective argument. She talks about how transferring childcare from a mainly unpaid, feminized, and invisible form of labor to a formal paid workplace is like a virtuous circle because now women with children can go to work and jobs are created when women or men, you know, decide to work in the childcare industry.
Yeah, and I mean, there's lots of problems with the childcare industry, but they did find that when Quebec introduced a public childcare system, they did find that women's labor force participation went up pretty substantially. So,
an organization that she quotes here estimates that the increased tax revenue, together with the reduced spending on Social Security benefits, would recoup between 95 and 90% of the annual childcare investment. So, like, paying for childcare almost pays for itself in taxes. I don't know. Women's unpaid work is work that society depends on, and it is work from which society as a whole benefits. Yes, please. Preach.
The last section of the book was a lot about like disasters and refugee camps. And there was some pretty shocking stuff in there. Like they, in several contexts, rebuilding efforts haven't like bothered to consult women. And as a result, they've been missing like full rooms from houses. And like they aren't providing like cookware or ability to cook, but they're providing like rice or other foods that you need to cook. And a good example of how gender inclusivity means that everybody gets rice to eat.
Yeah, because like women be feeding everybody, men and women. Like, I kind of liked that the last section focused on disasters. She makes the point, and I think you and I have made the point many times over, that climate change is going to result in more disaster management and relief management. And if we don't get it right, people die or suffer, right? And I don't know how much you want to talk about this, but you've done some disaster management. Any thoughts about that?
Just that like a lot of what she was saying was definitely true. So I think there's the point that we need to do a better job of ensuring that the response to climate change includes everybody. And that's like true internationally as well as within countries. But also, like, even if you just look at disaster assistance today, there are gendered effects that we often don't think about, and like other kinds of biases as well. But one really good example that she mentioned in the book is like gender-based violence, that in a lot of cases, disasters, because they like, they really disrupt people's lives and they create financial strain and they create mental health or exacerbate mental health issues. In a lot of cases, there's like an increase in domestic violence or child abuse or elder abuse. And in a lot of cases, that is gendered, not all, obviously, but so that's a problem. And then if you're a woman that's like already experiencing an abusive situation and you're in a disaster, you're even more financially precarious. So you're less likely to be able to leave that situation safely. And also, like, not to mention, we have a crisis of domestic violence shelters in this country. Women trying to flee domestic violence often get turned away because the shelters are full. Which is another point she makes in some section of the book, that like we often think about homelessness as like this thing that affects single men, and definitely does. And homelessness is shitty. Like our response to homelessness is really shitty and it makes single men really unsafe. But it is also doing that in sort of more hidden ways for women.
I mean, you and I think early in the podcast when we were doing like COVID specific episodes, we talked about that and how COVID being a pretty big disaster was in one way really bad for women, especially in already abusive situations, but it also like a lot of situations became abusive because people were like locked up together. And also because women couldn't leave and had nowhere to go because we were all like in lockdown. But then in a different way, when we started giving out CERB payments and like the $2,000 a month that people were just given to make sure that we could like pay our rent and eat food, it lifted so many women and children out of poverty, and it made it so that women could eventually like leave their, I don't know. It's complicated.
So this is where like I really wanted to see a positive program for this book because like, I came away from the book thinking like, okay, clearly she wants us to study women's issues more, which fair. But I also think that like there's an extent to which a lot of the problems that she's talking about, if you have generally inclusive policies, it fixes them, right? So like she talked about precarious work and how it hurts women more. If you address precarious work as a policy problem, it not only makes life better for women, but also other people who are in these sort of precarious work situations. You can do the same for like her example of active and public transit. And I mean, you brought up CERB. I think like universal basic income, which CERB kind of was asterisk for a limited period of time, like a universal basic income is a real equalizer that could have been talked about, right? Like there's this experiment that happened in Dauphin, Manitoba that's often talked about because it's sort of like one of the earlier documented universal basic income pilots. And it got canceled basically because there was this pearl-clutching moral panic because women started getting divorces when they had the financial security to leave abusive situations. So I really think this book was excellent and there was a lot of really good facts, but like it was just, there was such a missed opportunity to add at the end this positive program about like how you accomplish filling those data gaps, how you change society to address some of these inequities, how you stop gender-based violence, you know? It's that like from that book, The Persuaders, that we read a while ago. It's like you need a sandwich of like vision of a positive world, the world is shit, vision of a positive world. And that's kind of, for me, what was missing.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair critique. I think the book does focus a lot on what the world is like right now. And you and I tend to pick books that include a vision of, but what if it was better? And that's my favorite kind of book. But I also just felt that this book was so important that I was raving about it when you were asking me about it. And I was like, I just, it has so much in such a tight package that I think is really valuable, especially to business owners. Like, seriously, like if you are a business owner, you are almost certainly statistically a man. Please read this book. At least if you're a big, big business owner. If you're a small business owner, I'm sure you're equally likely to be a woman. I guess it depends on the business.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the stats are on that, but I would guess it's not 50-50.
She probably included it in this book. But the other thing is that the book is so wide in scope that she includes statistics from kind of all over the world, which is useful in the generic sense of what she's trying to get through, but not so helpful when I want to be like, oh, if you're in Canada, you're more likely to be a business owner of this size if you are a man or a woman. So, but I mean, a big part of her book was the point that it's actually impossible to find that data in some cases.
Just not studying it sometimes because it's costs more money, or they ran out of funding so they don't do the survey anymore, or a bunch of other stupid reasons like that.
There was a whole bunch of examples she gave where she's like, actually, they did include women in this study, but then they didn't. The data of like how many women and what their answers were was not included. So it's like not sex aggregated, which means that it's useless, essentially, if you want to use it to look at like the difference in gender politics on an issue.
Okay, so disaggregated data can be challenging. There are a bunch of reasons it can be hard to disaggregate in some cases, especially when you have small populations where there's a risk of like privacy concerns if you're, for example, the trans population, relatively small population, if you're also doing that data at like a local level, it's possible somebody might be able to find out who that person is, like based on disaggregating the data. Or there may just like not be enough sample size of a particular population in your study. That's a challenge that I think like is worth solving, but it is a real challenge for populations that are not 50% of the fucking population. This should never be an excuse for women versus men.
Love it. Any final thoughts on this book, or shall we say goodbye for the day?
I guess maybe we'll go with ratings. I think I give this one an 8 out of 10 because the receipts were really good. It was a really rigorously written book on an interesting theme. There was lots in it that I didn't know. But the missing two is just I wanted another chapter with a positive vision at the end.
I'm going to give this book, I'm going to go 9 out of 10 because I really liked it. I loved how sassy she was. I like that she obviously made an effort to not, you know, erase people's identities. And no book is going to be everything, as we said at the beginning. But I also really like that, like, yes, it's about women's issues specifically. And she's obviously a feminist, and this is very much from a feminist point of view. But the information that she's giving is so useful on so many different, like, basically for everything. Since I finished reading this book the first time, I've literally been like, who's giving this information? Where is this information coming from? Who is this for? I'm just questioning things in a totally different way than I was before. And maybe Kristen's already been doing that because, you know, you have a PhD. But I'm doing it a lot more and a lot more thoroughly than I was before. So 9 out of 10 for just making my brain a little bit bigger.
You know what book we should do in the future that's like on a similar theme? Judith Butler just wrote a new book called Who's Afraid of Gender? Everybody's afraid of gender. So excited.
Oh, yes. Okay, excellent. Sign us up. The end.